Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning in some places across the country. My name is Deborah Cox, and I serve as NACO's Deputy Executive Director and also lead our Government Affairs team. And we are so pleased that you've taken time out of your busy schedules to join our call today. We truly appreciate the entire NACO network for all of your advocacy efforts over the last few weeks and especially over the past few days with so much action going on with Congress and the administration, especially as they've negotiated this third emergency supplemental package. So again, thank you so much for joining our call today. If you have not yet heard or seen what is in the first two emergency packages that have been signed into law, you can access detailed NACO analysis on our website. Our hub for everything coronavirus related is accessible at naco.org/coronavirus, and you can check out some of the key highlights in those first two measures for counties. We also have a number of other resources there on that online hub, everything from federal updates to local best practices, as well as our constantly updated COVID-19 County Explorer map. The map includes emergency declarations and safer at home policies at the county and state level. And we've also just added FEMA disaster declarations as well. So you can click on your county or state on the map and view documents related to each of these declarations. If you see anything missing on the map, of course, let us know. We're happy to update it. And you can send those updates to research@naco.org. At this point, we think nationally there are about 600 counties that have declared a state of emergency. And at this point, more than 85 counties, along with 28 states, have issued business closure or safer at home policies. But today's call, we really wanted to focus on the third emergency supplemental package and provide you with some highlights for counties. We do have several members of our government affairs team who will provide some quick updates across their different portfolios. Our team is almost done with a comprehensive analysis document of the bill, and we'll be sending that out to everyone in just a few hours. So you should get that. It will go to the entire NACO membership. Throughout our call, if you have any questions, please submit those to research@naco.org. There are a number of provisions in the legislation that passed the Senate last night that will need further clarification, either, you know, to better understand the intent of Congress when writing the legislation or even working with some of our federal agency partners as they work to develop guidance and implement some of the policies and provisions included. So again, if you have questions, research@naco.org, just send a quick email. If we're not able to take all the questions on this phone call, our team will be sure to follow up after the call and try to get as many questions answered as possible. All right, so let's dive in, and we'll bring you up to speed. So quickly, after they passed the second supplemental package, that is H.R. 6201, as you know, Congress quickly shifted gears towards this third legislative package that would further address the economic impacts of the coronavirus. And as you saw through a lot of the confusion yesterday, negotiations continued right up until the vote in the Senate last night. There was a number of leaked drafts that had been released throughout the day that everybody thought was the final. Even the news and the media were confused about which version was the final, but they were finally able to get a vote in the Senate last night. The measure is called the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, called CARES. It's H.R. 748 and does include some associated emergency supplemental appropriations. It's actually the largest emergency package in U.S. history and provides $2 trillion towards coronavirus relief efforts. This package will direct a lot of money towards providing loans and grants to a lot of major industries and small businesses, direct cash payments to taxpayers, and does expand unemployment benefits. But most importantly, it does provide some additional resources that counties can use towards our response efforts. So after passage last night, the Senate has now gone into recess, and all eyes are on the U.S. House of Representatives today as leadership plans their next moves on the legislation. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer did announce late yesterday that the House will attempt to pass the coronavirus response bill on Friday through a voice vote, and that is a process that would not require all members of Congress to be in Washington. House Republican leaders at this point have said that they also support that strategy. However, it is a bit dicey since at this point any House member could demand a recorded roll call vote, which could drag out the process of trying to get members back to D.C. in person. So that's a little bit about the process and next steps. But now turning to some key provisions in the legislation, again, I'm joined by several members of our NACO legislative team to help provide updates. But one of the most important items included in the bill is $150 billion for the state stabilization fund that many of you reached out to your members of Congress on and saw some of our action alerts around. They actually ended up officially naming that fund not the state stabilization fund, but it's called the Coronavirus Relief Fund in the actual text of the legislation. So there is a lot that we still need to clarify with Congress and Treasury around that $150 billion. But here are some of the things that we do know. Again, the total amount is $150 billion for states, tribal governments, and units of local government for FY 2020. Of that $150 billion total, the bill reserves $3 billion for D.C. and the American territories, $8 billion for tribes, and that leaves about $139 billion for states and direct payments to eligible units of local government above 500,000 populations. The legislation does state that no state shall receive less than $1.25 billion. Any direct payments to eligible units of local government shall be reduced from the state's total allocation. And at this point, it appears that 45% of the state's allocation can be eligible for direct payments to those units of local governments above 500,000 that meet eligibility requirements. But again, we're going to need some clarification on the formula for this and eligibility. They do define unit of local government in the legislation for direct payments. They say county, municipality, town, township, village, parish, borough, or other unit of local government below the state level with a population that exceeds 500,000. They do specify use of funds to include necessary expenditures incurred due to the public health emergency of COVID-19. They say that funds can also be used for budget costs not accounted in the most recent adopted budget and costs incurred from March 1st through December 30th of 2020. Of important note for counties, this does not appear to cover lost revenue due to COVID-19. And again, that is something that we'll need to seek clarity on and potentially push for moving forward. The legislation states that the chief executive for units of local government shall sign a certification of proposed usage of funds, and that U.S. Treasury shall pay each state, including the eligible units of local government, within 30 days. So again, we need clarity, but it appears that direct payments to units of local government above 500,000 can get direct funding through Treasury. We'll need clarification on how counties and local governments below the population threshold can access funds through the state. And I know there is a lot of questions around how counties and cities can work together to get to that 500,000 population threshold. So that is what we do know. Again, I'll say it again, there's a lot of clarification, and we'll probably need to push Congress and the Treasury Department on some of these issues. But at this point, we will hand it over to Blair Bryant on our team to cover some of the key health provisions in the legislation.
Thanks, Deborah. Good afternoon, everyone. I hope you all are safe and well. As mentioned, I'm just going to go over a few quick updates as it relates to health. So beyond some of the direct economic assistance provided in the legislation, the CARES Act builds upon some of the aid that was provided to healthcare facilities in the earlier bills. As a top-level highlight of the bill, it would give hospitals and healthcare facilities a funding boost for response efforts. The bill includes a $100 billion fund that would reimburse eligible healthcare providers for healthcare-related expenses or lost revenues that are attributable to coronavirus. Eligible healthcare providers are defined in the bill as public entities, Medicare or Medicaid enrolled suppliers and providers, and other healthcare facilities. So we are looking to the Department of Health and Human Services in the coming days to provide further guidance and clarification on how we can access these funds. Secondly, the bill would provide support for community health centers. In addition to the supplemental funding that we saw in the first relief package for health centers, this bill would provide $1.32 billion in fiscal year 2020 for supplemental awards for the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of COVID-19 in these facilities. These services would be administered by the Health Resources and Services Administration and is a definite win for all of us given the county role as safety net providers for low-income and indigent residents who often receive their care through county-operated health centers. The supplemental funds would offset the tremendous financial burden on our local systems of care outside of the hospital setting. So lastly, I will just highlight that the bill protects payments to hospitals that are serving the uninsured and underinsured by delaying the statutory cuts to Medicaid disproportionate share hospital payments or DSH payments until November 30th of this year, and then the cuts will be slated to take place in fiscal year 2021. This would help hospitals in our communities that are serving the medically indigent and underinsured to make up for, again, revenue losses and continue to provide high-quality health care to all patients, especially during this time of crisis. So those are just the top-level highlights, but the legislation also makes some noteworthy strides to strengthen the public health workforce, fund community mental health services, and works to increase the availability of personal protective equipment, which I know was a big item that we were writing to Congress about following the passage of the earlier two bills. So all of this is outlined in full detail in our analysis, and I'm happy to take any questions on these, but for now I will turn it over to my colleague, Rachel Merker.
Thank you so much, Blair. Hi, everybody. My name is Rachel Merker, and I am the Associate Legislative Director of Human Services and Education here at NACO. I just want to provide a quick overview of some of the notable provisions in the bill with respect to human services. Like Blair said, there's a lot more detail in our analysis, but the items that I would like to highlight for you all today are that first, when it comes to helping households access nutritious food, the bill provides $15 billion in a new contingency reserve fund for the federal food stamp program. It also provides $9 billion in extra funding for child nutrition programs. So coupled with some of the new flexibilities that the supplemental package provided for these nutrition programs, the funding should help you all meet growing demand for food assistance in your community. Another thing I want to point out is that the bill will offer one-time direct financial assistance to individuals who are earning less than $75,000 a year. Those folks will get a check for $1,200 in the mail. Married couples who are earning less than $150,000 a year will get a check for $2,400. And those amounts will both increase by $500 for each qualifying child living in the household. These checks will grow smaller by $5 for each $100 in income over those thresholds I just mentioned until they hit zero. The IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, is going to be responsible for sending these checks in the mail, and most Americans will not have to do anything to initiate receiving this money because they're going to go off of last year's or this year's tax filings as well as Social Security data where applicable. So we are hopeful that this will relieve some financial pressure for your residents and in turn for your social services systems as you are dealing with so much increased demand. With respect to those of you who administer federally funded child care programs, you'll also be seeing some additional resources to deal with the coronavirus. The bill increases funding for the federal child care subsidy program by $3.5 billion, and that money will be available until next September of 2021. The legislation specifically will allow these funds to help meet child care needs of first responders and other essential workers, regardless of their income during the crisis, which is a shift from the normal rules guiding this federal program. Finally, I just want to mention we understand the critical role that you all play in providing networks of support to elderly Americans, often through local area agencies on aging. And we know that the coronavirus is placing so much additional pressure on the existing challenges facing our rapidly growing aging population, whether it's social isolation or accessing resources. So I'm glad to report that the bill also includes nearly $1 billion for local aging agencies to deliver meals to seniors, provide home-based services, support caregivers, and equip nursing homes to protect residents. So happy to answer questions, and you can also send those in to the research email, but for now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Erin Hurley.
Thanks so much, Rachel. Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon. As Rachel mentioned, my name is Erin Hurley, and I handle NACO's Finance, Pensions, and Intergovernmental Affairs policy portfolio. So for my update today, it's just two major provisions that I wanted to highlight. First is that the CARES Act establishes a new $454 billion Economic Stabilization Fund that permits the U.S. Department of Treasury to purchase outstanding debt of states, local governments, instrumentalities, and political subdivisions of them. So what this means is that the bill permits the Federal Reserve to participate in the secondary municipal bond market as an investor in municipal debt. And I'm sure, as many of you know, just as the equities market and the corporate market took a tumble over the past week, so too did the municipal bond market. Asking the Federal Reserve to purchase bonds already issued would help energize the flow of bonds in the secondary market, leading to a rehabilitation of pricing on the primary market. Overall, pretty much said simply, this would allow having the Federal Reserve buying municipal debt and municipal bonds will help decrease borrowing costs in the long run for counties. In addition to providing the Federal Reserve with this authority, the $454 billion fund also provides loans and loan guarantees to small businesses. And then switching gears a little bit to the election side, the Senate CARES Act provides $400 million in election assistance for the states and localities to help prepare for the 2020 election cycle, specifically including to increase the ability to vote by mail, expand early voting and online registration, and increase the safety of voting in person by providing additional voting facilities and more poll workers. There are additional details in the weeds regarding some of the more finance-focused provisions included in the bill. Similar to my colleagues, more than happy to answer questions on those details. But for now, I will turn it over to my colleague, Jessica Jennings, to provide an update on the transportation provisions. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Erin. Hi, everyone. This is Jessica Jennings. As she mentioned, I handle transportation issues for NACO. Thank you guys for getting on the phone with us. While we know you're very busy, thanks for all the hard work you're doing across the country and your local communities. So for transportation, we did not see anything in the first two packages, but are definitely excited to see some funding for transportation in the most recent package that Congress passed last night. I'll quickly cover that. So there's $10 billion provided for airports, and that's through the Airport Improvement Program. You guys probably know airports are entitled to a certain level of AIP funding each year based on their passenger traffic and their capital needs. If the needs do exceed what is provided through AIP, discretionary funding can be transferred from the general fund, which actually did happen in FY 2020 regular appropriations. However, this appears to be all formula. So the $10 billion divided in four ways. There is not less than $7.4 billion for any airport project that would typically be funded by user fees. And then that $7.4 billion is allocated based on a sponsoring airport percentage of total year employment in 2018 calendar year, and then their debt versus their reserves in FY18. In addition to that, there's $500 million allocated to provide a 100% federal cost share for any project completed under this section. No more than $2 billion provided for any purpose that revenues would go, the airport revenues would typically fund, and that's also a portion based on statute. And then finally, not less than $100 million made available to general aviation airports, which are obviously our airports that do not have scheduled air service. In addition to that funding, there's also $56 million provided in additional supplemental FY20 appropriations for the Essential Air Service, which is a program that ensures air service can continue to small and rural communities following the Deregulation Act in the 70s. So that's all for airports. In addition, there is $25 billion for public transit. It is allocated also through formulas, through four different formulas, urban transit grants, rural area transit grants, state of good repair grants, and growing states and high-density grant programs. The Senate version only had it going to urban and rural areas, but the House compromise is the one that made it in, and they divided into the four. You guys may know 100% of federal transit dollars are allocated through formulas, so depending on the structure of the transit system in your area, if your state gets the money usually, if the regional transit system gets it, or if a local transit system gets it, that's how this funding will also come. In addition to those funding numbers, more than $1 billion provided to continue the federal support of Amtrak. And then just one other thing I did want to flag for you guys that made it into the bill in some rather tricky language in Division B and general provisions, there is a waiver on heavy truck weight limits. So this was pushed by ASTO, and we did have a heads up. Unfortunately, they had the legal authority to do this. I believe it was provided under MAP 21, which is the reauthorization prior to the FAST Act. We're definitely monitoring this right now. It is set for the end of the fiscal year, so September 30th. We want to make sure states don't turn this into some sort of case study for why heavy trucks are needed, et cetera. So I'm definitely monitoring that as we move forward and just want you to be aware of that. In addition, before I turn it over to Daria, we've heard there may be a fourth package and it may include infrastructure. So we'll be pushing heavy for that, working with lawmakers. Have heard that they potentially might try to transfer general fund money to the Highway Trust Fund, so it would make the reauthorization easier when the FAST Act expires in September. But very tentative, so stay tuned. We'll keep you posted, and happy to take any questions you have through the email that Deborah provided. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Daria.
Great. Thank you, Jessica. Good afternoon or morning again. This is Daria Daniel, and I'm the Associate Legislative Director for Community Economic and Workforce Development, and really appreciate you all joining us. I'm going to be talking about just some of the labor provisions as well as a couple of key housing and economic development programs that I'll highlight. Regarding the CARES Act, one thing that was not included is a technical fix so that county governments would be eligible for payroll tax credits established under the second supplemental appropriations bill, H.R. 6201, or the Families First Corona Response Act. That legislation added new family medical leave provisions, which required counties to provide their employees with paid sick leave and expanded family and medical leave for specified reasons related to COVID-19 beginning on April 1st. The CARES Act does provide some limitations on this, though. The CARES Act creates limitations for employers to provide no more than $511 per day and or $5,110 in the aggregate for an employee who is unable to work due to direct effects of COVID-19 or $200 per day and $2,000 in the aggregate for an employee caring for an individual experiencing the effects of COVID-19. The CARES Act does include $15 billion for the Department of Labor to implement the new paid leave and emergency unemployment insurance related to COVID-19. The bill provides an additional $600 per week for up to 4 months in unemployment benefits for workers that lose their jobs due to COVID-19. We know that many of you have questions around the new FMLA provisions, which we have been sharing with DOL. And we are also working to secure a speaker from DOL to participate in one of these NACO calls soon to provide information and answer questions directly. In the interim, DOL has released a couple of information guidance and a frequently asked question, which is available on their website at www.dol.gov/agencies/WHD/FMLA/pandemic. These resources should also be on NACO's website, and we will share any new information that we receive from DOL regarding the FMLA provisions as soon as possible. A couple of other things that I wanted to mention related to housing and economic development is that in a major win for you all, the bill provides an additional $5 billion for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Community Development Block Grant, or CDBG, a critical funding source for housing, infrastructure, and economic development programs in your community. Of the $5 billion, $2 billion will be allocated to states and localities based on the current program's formula. The bill then includes an additional $1 billion to be distributed directly for states. The remaining $2 billion will be allocated by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development based on a formula to be determined by HUD Secretary based on coronavirus-related factors. Additionally, the bill waives the 15% public services cap for CDBG, which helps fund grantees that they can allocate to nonprofit organizations. So this is a really big key win, I think, in this legislation. It also provides increased funding for the Economic Development Administration. The bill includes an additional $1.5 billion for the U.S. Department of Commerce's EDA to be available through September 30th, 2022. Funding for EDA is important for private sector job creation at the local level, and will be helpful as you all develop a response to the negative impacts of COVID-19 in local communities. So those are just a couple of the major housing and economic development provisions, as well as the latest information we have on the FMLA provisions. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have through the research, and I will now turn it over to my colleague, Jonathan Shutfield.
Thanks, Daria, and thanks everybody for joining the call today. I've been tasked with giving you a brief update on what was included for the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, as well as the Burn Justice Assistant Grant, or JAG, program under the Department of Justice. I'll start by talking about FEMA. The legislation puts aside $45 billion for FEMA's Disaster Relief Fund. That's compared to about $18 billion in the FY 2020 spending package that was signed by the President in December. So you can see it's about three times what was already set aside by Congress. The disaster fund provides for the immediate needs of state, local, tribal, and territorial governments, as well as private nonprofits performing critical and essential services and to help them recover from the effects of COVID-19. These activities can include medical response, personal protective equipment, National Guard deployment, coordination of logistics, safety measures, and other community services around the country. This money, this $45 billion, is in addition to any money and equipment that's been freed up by any of the emergency declarations declared by the President over the past couple of weeks. And one thing to keep in mind is of that $45 billion in the disaster relief fund that Congress is putting into it now, $25 billion of that will be set aside for the Robert T. Stafford Act emergency major disaster declarations. So there's the potential that not all of this money will go directly to coronavirus. Some of it will possibly go to you know, other major disasters on the line, like hurricanes and things like that, in order to fill that pot of money in the interim. Additionally, there's another $400 million for FEMA to provide additional federal assistance in preparation and response, and it's going to be divided up in the following ways. That's $400 million. There will be $100 million for assistance to firefighters grants. These are direct grants to fire departments for the purchase of protective gear, supplies, and related reimbursements to those purchases. There's another $100 million set aside for emergency management performance grants to meet the national preparedness goal, which is a national plan that lays out in six steps how communities can be prepared for disasters moving forward. And so this money will be directed to helping you to plan for the next disaster and to plan for this disaster moving forward. And then there's another $200 million for the Emergency Food and Shelter Program. This will supplement and expand the work of local governments and charitable organizations in times of economic emergencies. This money is actually this money can be paid out without a presidential disaster declaration. So this is money that can go straight out to those food banks and local governments immediately in times like this. Moving on from FEMA, a couple of other areas within the Department of Homeland Security I wanted to highlight. The Transportation Security Administration will get an additional $100 million for sanitizing security checkpoints and other airport common areas, overtime and travel costs for staff, and additional explosive detection material. The U.S. Coast Guard will receive an additional $141 million for the mobilization of reservists and expanding the Coast Guard's IT systems and infrastructure. And the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency will receive an additional $9 million to provide critical infrastructure and cybersecurity coordination activities among different federal agencies in response to the virus. Moving on to the Department of Justice, I mentioned at the beginning of the call the Burn Justice Assistance Grant Program, also known as the Burn JAG Program. Congress is putting another $850 million into the Burn JAG program. There was about $550 million in the 2020 appropriations package signed by the President in December. So you can see $850 is even more than what was set aside initially. But this is to help counties and other eligible local entities to address the needs of their local police departments and jails. This money can be used for purchases of personal protective equipment and other needed medical items to support the overtime of officers who are on the front lines right now. This program is generally used for things like that, as well as equipment for police departments, vehicles, et cetera. So with that, I will go ahead and I believe turn it back over to Deborah Cox.
All right. Thank you so much to our team. We will now turn to some questions that have been submitted. Again, if you have questions, submit them to research@nico.org. And if we don't have time or they're very technical, we'll answer them and follow up later. We have received probably 20 questions just on the congressional process and next steps. So just to clarify again, the measure, this third supplemental appropriations package, has only been passed by the U.S. Senate. The Senate passed it last night, and now they've gone into recess. Now that Senate legislation heads over to the House, where they are hoping to have a voice vote on Friday. And so by doing a voice vote, that would mean that the members of Congress do not have to travel to D.C. for a vote. But again, that is very dicey given the dynamics that if anyone objects in the House, they could, it might not be that smooth of sailing. So right now, the leadership are working to ensure that members in the House right now agree to the Senate bill as passed. So a lot of ongoing dynamics, but again, their goal is to pass it and, or consider it and then pass it on the House floor on Friday. And then, yes, it would need to be signed into law by President Trump, and from there would be implemented. So I hope that clarifies some of the process. Probably the second most popular topic that we've received questions around is that $150 billion for the state stabilization fund. Remember that that's the technical title is the Coronavirus Relief Fund. There are a lot of questions, again, that we'll have to seek clarification on, both from the intent of Congress and also implementation and guidance through the U.S. Treasury Department. But again, just because the legislation is currently silent on counties or local governments below that 500,000 population, it doesn't necessarily mean that local governments aren't eligible. The bill just doesn't go into complete detail. So that is definitely a key issue that we'll be working with Congress and the Treasury Department to clarify. As of this morning, there are 100 different interpretations of that Coronavirus Relief Fund and who is eligible and how. So bear with us, be patient, and it might be something that we need your help on to push for clarification in a fourth package. So again, stay tuned as we work with some of our federal partners for clarification on that. We did receive a question on airports, which says, does the airport funding apply to private as well as public airports? And I'll let Jessica Dennings on our team answer that question.
Thanks, Deborah. So the way that the airport improvement program defines a public use airport is, yes, a privately owned airport would be included if it's used or intended to be used for public purposes. So if it's a reliever airport or if it is determined by the secretary to be a public use airport, which basically would mean it has more than 2,500 passengers every year. So hopefully that's helpful.
Great, thank you. We did receive another question on the direct financial assistance payments that the IRS will be sending to individuals. Rachel, can you provide any clarity and more details around those financial assistance payments?
Yeah, absolutely. So we got a question asking how the IRS was going to determine household income to figure out the size of the check that people will be getting. The answer to that question is that they are going to go off of 2019 tax filings if those are available. However, a lot of you probably saw that they delayed the 2019 tax deadline. So say a household hasn't filed their 2019 tax returns, then the IRS would go off of the 2018 tax filing data. It's also important to note, though, that even if a household didn't file taxes, like perhaps because they didn't have any income, the Social Security Administration has data particularly on households who, for instance, receive federal benefits. And so wherever they can't find data through the IRS for households, they are going to be looking at the Social Security Administration as well to figure out who is eligible for this financial assistance and for how much money. So I think that was the main question we got so far about the direct financial assistance. We expect that to be, we expect the IRS to move on that pretty quickly, and it'll be very similar to what happened with the response in 2008-2009 when folks got checks in the mail.
All right, thank you, Rachel. And then just wanted to remind everybody, you know, on that coronavirus relief fund, that $150 billion that I was just talking about that needs more clarification, just as a reminder, you know, it's due to all of your efforts on the phone and all of our NACO members that counties are even eligible in the first place. You know, the states fought very, very hard to keep that $150 billion just for them. So the fact that some counties are eligible is great, but of course we want to ensure that our rural counties are eligible for that funding as well. So again, a top priority to receive clarification on that. Another question
has to do with the specifics of who at Treasury the certification forms on population figures should be sent to. We do not know exactly who at Treasury these certifications should be sent to, and we will follow up with more guidance on that. We did receive a question, where can MACO's analysis on all three COVID-19 legislative packages be found? That is on our MACO coronavirus hub. You can find that at www.maco/coronavirus. And our analysis for this third package is almost done, and we'll be sending it to the full membership shortly and posting it online. We did have a question on LIHEAP and what funding was provided in the bill, and I'll turn that over to the team to answer.
Hi, folks. This is Rachel again. LIHEAP is the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. It is a program by which the federal government provides funds for grantees to give low-income, disabled, elderly households, vulnerable households who need help with emergency heat and energy needs. And the bill does include an additional $900 million for that program to be available through September of 2021.
All right. Great. Thank you. And with that, again, we did receive a number of other questions, very technical or ones that we don't quite have answers to just yet. So we'll be sure to circle back with you as soon as we're able to answer those. Again, thank you so much for joining our call today. We're truly appreciative of all your efforts, not only every day, but also on some of these federal policy issues. If our team can be of assistance moving forward, please don't hesitate to reach out to any one of us on our government affairs team or NACO more broadly. I will highlight that this afternoon, NACO will be holding another national call for rural community resources around the coronavirus, where we will be joined by several speakers from the USDA, SBC, SBA, and also EPA. So that is today at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Would also note that along the lines of federal agencies releasing additional guidance on some of the more complex issues, we spoke to FEMA yesterday. For those of you going to file for reimbursement through the Public Assistance Fund, FEMA is working to create a new simplified form that you can use to apply for those funds, and they hope to release it within the next week, so stay tuned on that. And then also, as Daria mentioned, the Department of Labor is working to issue some more guidance on the Family Medical Leave Act issues for employers and employees. So we anticipate further guidance there, too. Also, just of note, we will most likely be having another national call tomorrow, Friday, with some special guests from CDC's Infectious Disease group, just to give an update from a more medical perspective on the virus itself, and we're hopeful that they'll be able to take questions from the membership. But again, thank you so much for joining our call today, and we'll talk to you soon.